This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson, and I don't need to tell you. We are living through some scary times that most of us never imagined could happen. So I'm standing outside my house right now, and my neighborhood is normally pretty busy this time of day. It's family-friendly, pulsating with life, but now there are hardly any cars on the road. The absence of little kids' laughter, it's eerie. It's like we're all trapped in a story and not reality. I'll admit, it's easy for me to go there because I read a lot of post-apocalyptic stories. The one that stands out in my mind right now is Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler. It's about the collapse of society and a woman who forms a community out of the remnants. You know, the book makes it clear that when the world is falling apart, well, it's not just one thing, it's all the things. In this era we're in, that feels true as we grapple with the medical crisis surrounding COVID-19. There's also the financial one.
We are going into a global recession.
This is worse than 2008. This is worse than 1987.
In fact, we anticipate the worst economic fallout since the Great Depression.
Now, we all hope it doesn't go that way, but many of the world's leading economists believe we could be facing the worst crash in close to a century. That's despite Congress passing a $2.2 trillion stimulus package.
Well, thank you all very much. It's a very important day. I'll sign the single biggest economic relief package in American history, and I must say,
that relief package provided hundreds of billions of dollars for small businesses. But from the start, it was plagued with problems. People found it hard to apply for, and it's already run out of money. We're going to spend today's show talking to small business owners and their employees. With more than 20 million Americans now out of work, we start by looking at whether this crisis could end with people losing the very homes they've been forced to isolate themselves in. Here's Reveal's Aaron Glantz.
There's this little house about 40 miles northeast of San Francisco at the end of a commuter rail line. It's a single-story bungalow built in 1923 in the old downtown of Pittsburgh, California.
It means everything right now because this is where my kids can be in a safe place.
Monica Perez is sheltering in place here with her two kids.
I believe with this pandemic that we have right now, this is the only place where they can feel safe.
Monica's a single mom and a preschool teacher, but she lost her job last month when the school shut down because of the coronavirus. And for weeks, she's been trying to reach her bank.
Thank you for calling Wells Fargo. You've reached our customer assistance line. We're here to help during this.
She calls and calls, but can't get anyone on the phone.
If you are calling for assistance due to COVID-19 impacts, please listen closely.
The bills keep adding up. Not only Monica's mortgage, there's also the electric bill, food, gas. She's worried about losing her home.
At this critical time, we are working to serve you as quickly as possible. Please stay safe and take care of yourself and your loved ones.
Monica bought this house for $130,000 in 2011, right after the housing bust. It's more than doubled in value since then. Her home is her life savings, and her mortgage payment is her largest monthly expense. Wells Fargo is offering borrowers like Monica forbearance, which means that she doesn't have to pay her mortgage right now. But she will eventually.
They're going to accumulate that on your mortgage. So no, that's not going to work for us.
Wells Fargo's profits are way down because of the coronavirus, but it still entered this crisis flush with cash. The bank returned $30 billion to shareholders through stock buybacks and dividends last year and still reported $20 billion in profit. Monica says she has 2 months' worth of savings.
We need those bills to be canceled, like canceled.
Like millions of Americans, Monica doesn't know how long she'll be out of work. And every month she doesn't pay her mortgage, she's worried the ultimate bill will be that much bigger. And that she'll never be able to catch up, even if she gets her old job back.
How are we going to do this? Because the job is going to be the same one. The pay is going to be the same one. How are we going to do this? And I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one.
Monica is stuck at home and stuck on hold, wondering what's going to happen to her. And the powerful people who are supposed to help her and millions of other Americans are sheltering in place, too.
I am working from home, out of my home office.
That's Mark Calabria. You may not have heard of him, but he's one of the most powerful people in America when it comes to housing. He helped lead the libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute. President Trump appointed him director of the Federal Housing Finance Agency. Now he controls almost half of all mortgages in America for both homeowners and landlords. And like the rest of us, he's not sure what's going to happen next.
If you've got a crystal ball and can tell me where we're going to be in 3 months, I really would appreciate you sharing that with me.
Stuck at home, Mark Calabria has still taken action. He suspended foreclosures on loans owned by the giant government-controlled mortgage companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, for people hurt by the crisis. The $2 trillion stimulus took those protections even further. Here's what that means for you. If you're a homeowner with one of these loans and you've lost your job, Calabria says you should ask your bank to put off your payments, and the banks have to do it. If you're a landlord and your tenants can't pay their rent because of the pandemic, you're supposed to get relief too. And if you're a tenant, it's a little confusing. If you're living in a building where the landlord has a mortgage backed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, you're protected from eviction.
We at the federal level have said, if you, landlord, have a federal-backed mortgage, we will give you forbearance in order to pass that along to your tenants who may have lost their jobs or loss of income.
But here's the problem. Almost nobody knows who owns their mortgage. It's rarely the company you write your monthly check to. And if homeowners don't know who owns their mortgage, you better believe tenants have no clue who owns their landlords. Calabria says tenants should just ask.
But really, if you're a tenant and you can't make your rent, first person you should talk to is your landlord. And if your landlord says, well, you know, if you don't pay rent, then how do I pay my mortgage? You can always say, and you can say to the landlord, listen, if you have a Fannie or Freddie mortgage, they will give you forbearance because the rent can't be paid.
You're telling tenants who are often very vulnerable to call their landlord and ask their landlord who has the mortgage on the property.
Agreed. I would be the first to say it is a convoluted and it's not the cleanest solution, but it's also as a regulator of Fannie and Freddie with the mortgage, it's the only solution I can offer.
It's a solution built for a short-term crisis, but there are already signs we're likely heading for a bigger downturn. Tens of millions of people have already filed for unemployment, and many homeowners doubt delaying their mortgage payments will be enough to save them.
What do you say to the preschool teacher that I talked to who's now out of work, doesn't know when she's going to get her job back, and would just like the mortgage payments during the crisis to be canceled?
I think that's something she needs to take up with Congress. I don't have the ability to do that. Our objective at the end of the day is to get everybody back on their feet and keep them in their home. If this goes longer, we'll have longer-term solutions, but with the hope that we are only in this situation for 2 to 3 months.
During the 2008 housing crisis, the banks that helped cause the collapse by issuing millions of bad loans got a massive bailout. And now, American banks are in great financial shape. They cleared $230 billion in profit last year. So I asked Calabria why struggling Americans should have to make up their payments instead of forcing the banks and government-run mortgage companies to eat that loss. Fannie Mae, which he oversees, made $14 billion last year.
I appreciate that. Fannie and Freddie have a combined $5 trillion footprint. So let us put it this way. For instance, if were we simply to forgive mortgage payments for all of Fannie and Freddie's book, they'd go bankrupt in 2 weeks. Since I'm responsible for that not happening, the broader question of whether there should be a mortgage or rent holiday, that's a question for Congress. I'm not a legislator. I'm a regulator.
Like everyone else, members of Congress are not supposed to leave the house right now.
I can come upstairs next to the bedroom in a small, cramped office.
Congressman Chuy Garcia spoke to us from his home, a single-family house on the southwest side of Chicago. He tried and failed to put stronger tenant protections, including a national moratorium on evictions, into the $2 trillion stimulus bill President Trump signed last month. That bill passed without a single hearing. Garcia says it was difficult for even members of Congress to be heard.
The last bill was the biggest single bill enacted by Congress in its history, with only a handful of people actually meeting face to face, mostly doing the negotiation via phone. So it's a very exclusive process, even more so than the normal process in Washington. That's what you get.
Garcia says he'll keep pushing. There's going to be another stimulus bill, and he's trying to include $100 billion to help vulnerable tenants pay rent.
People are going to remember that the big financial institutions that were bailed out in the 2008 agreement were many of the same culprits who brought about the financial meltdown on Wall Street that was attributable to sheer greed. What people know in the onset of the pandemic is that they need help and they expect the government to help them in their time of need.
The Trump administration is already negotiating with Congress over what the next aid package will look like. Representative Maxine Waters is on the deal-making team. She's chair of the Financial Services Committee, one of the most powerful Democrats in Congress. I reached her at her home in Los Angeles.
We will be doing everything that we can to make sure that people can have a decent quality of life and that they won't be so burdened that they give up, that they walk away, or that they lose their homes. And so we're going to do real good oversight.
But it's been tough. Waters tried to get a national moratorium on all foreclosures, no matter which company owns the mortgage, into the last stimulus. That didn't happen. And she wanted $300 million to prevent banks and landlords from discriminating against people of color during the pandemic. She got a fraction of that, just $2.5 million. But the kind of relief that out-of-work preschool teacher Monica Perez wants, to have her mortgage payments during the crisis not just delayed, but disappear, Maxine Waters doesn't see that happening.
I do not at this point, but I sympathize with that, I identify with that, and that would be an extraordinarily generous thing for this country to do for its homeowners. What I like to see, forbearance, I like to see each individual worked with by their bank, by their servicer, so that you can figure out what their incomes are, what the debts are, how they will be able to manage.
That's exactly what out-of-work homeowners are trying to do right now.
Welcome to Wells Fargo Home Lending Customer Assistance. Please hold while I transfer you.
Monica was still having trouble getting anyone from Wells Fargo on the phone.
Well, I've been calling them, continue doing the same thing that I have to do. I can't get a hold of anybody yet.
I started working with Monica, trying to figure out if her loan was owned by one of the big government-controlled mortgage companies, Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. I walked her through some tools, which are buried on a Treasury Department website.
So where it says Know Your Options, Loan Lookup, click there.
No, it's not them.
So I dug into the property record and found Monica's loan is backed by another government agency, the Federal Housing Administration. That mortgage is also covered by the stimulus package. It means that Monica can delay making payments for up to a year. She won't be fined for late payments, but eventually she'll have to make it all up. It's not what she wanted, but it will keep her and her children in their house for now.
That story was from Reveal's Aaron Glantz and Catherine Miskowski. Aaron reached out to Wells Fargo and asked them what was going on with Monica's loan. They didn't want to talk, but a spokesperson emailed saying someone would get in touch with Monica to review her options and get her the assistance she needs. Homeowners aren't the only ones struggling. Small businesses are also looking for help to stay afloat during this crisis. That story is coming up next on Reveal.
Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal. Odoo, modern management made simple.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Unemployment claims are at an all-time high, with more expected as social distancing continues. With most of the country in some form of lockdown, chances are you aren't making any hotel reservations anytime soon. That's hit the $200 billion hotel industry pretty hard. While you may be familiar with brand names like Hilton, Hyatt, and Marriott, most of the hotels you stay in are actually owned by small businesses. That's because over 90% of the nearly 33,000 hotels in the United States are franchised. And those franchise owners are the ones struggling to keep employees on the job. Reveal's Jonathan Jones has more.
Thank you for calling. It's David Bismond. I can help you.
Yes, I'm looking to talk with Mo.
Yes, how can I help you?
I reach Mohammed Islam, or Mo, at the front desk of the Holiday Inn Express and Suites in Columbus, Ohio. It's a slow day. Really slow.
Yes, nobody here. Empty right now.
Normally, the spring season is packed, as fitness enthusiasts from around the world flock into town for the Arnold Sports Festival. It's one of the city's largest gatherings, hosted by, yes, Arnold Schwarzenegger. But the event was canceled due to concerns about the coronavirus.
I think it was the right thing to do because we want to keep people safe and we want to keep people healthy.
The morning I talked to Mo, fewer than 10 rooms out of the hotel's 100 are occupied.
The pool is closed. Is actually only one person in the front desk. If you see in the morning time, maybe one or two guests come down for the checkout, or they go outside as a pin drop silence. Yeah. Can you put on hold, please?
Yeah, go ahead.
Many of the rooms have been vacant for more than a month. The conference rooms are locked, and a lounge near the lobby has been blocked off.
Sorry for holding.
No, that's all fine. You got to do your job.
Mo was born in Bangladesh and moved to Columbus in 2012 so his wife could be closer to her family. He started on the night shift, making minimum wage, and gradually worked his way up to a salaried front desk position. He says he now brings home close to $2,000 a month. With schools closed, his wife has stopped working to take care of their two young kids. The monthly bills, however, stop for no one. There's the $220 for the Hyundai Sonata, $1,000 for the mortgage. His savings, he says, will only last a month or two. So every day, even as the COVID-19 crisis deepens, Mo keeps showing up for work.
Sometimes I worried about for the kids, for the virus also.
Mo says he's grateful to still have a job, even though his hours have been reduced. No one at this hotel has been laid off, at least not yet, but that possibility is on everyone's mind.
You know, it's unprecedented. It's something that we've never seen before. And it's
And that's a first in our industry.
Manav Singh is Moe's boss. He co-owns this Holiday Inn Express with his dad, along with the Staybridge Suites next door.
I think you saw close to $500,000 worth of business from each one of the hotels just vanish overnight.
Between their two hotels, Manav and his dad are struggling to keep 50 people on the payroll.
Some of our employees have been with us for more than 10 years. Our executive housekeeper drives 55 miles a day one way from Mount Gilead, Ohio, and she has been with my dad ever since he was just a general manager of a hotel 18 years ago.
Manav and his dad run their hotels as franchisees of the Intercontinental Hotels Group, or IHG, which includes brands like Holiday Inn and Crowne Plaza. Like fast food restaurants and car dealerships, the franchise hotel model relies on a company, in this case IHG, to provide a brand name, some standards, and general operating procedures. In turn, the local franchise owner puts up the money for the business, takes on the mortgage or the construction debt, hires the employees, and essentially has the responsibility of running the place. They also pay fees to the parent company for things like marketing, upkeep, and reservations. In recent years, it was generally a profitable model for both sides of this equation. But when things go wrong, like when a global pandemic wipes out your entire revenue base seemingly overnight, it's franchise owners like Manav who are left trying to keep things afloat.
There's no IHG corporate officers, corporate employees standing at our desks taking care of situations that we face firsthand.
Manav says he's become increasingly frustrated with what he sees as a lack of guidance and assistance from the corporate office. As the crisis unfolded, IHG was sending emails telling owners they should close the pool, shut down the breakfast bar, lock up the fitness center. But he says that's not the type of guidance he needed.
I mean, none of us would be hoteliers today if we didn't know that right off the bat. What I think the owners would have loved to have seen was communication. Hey guys, we are working on helping all of you financially in some capacity. Stay tuned.
Manav went to the online forum of the IHG Owners Association, which was flooded with posts. The association is independently run but housed inside corporate headquarters in Atlanta. Online, owners were asking lots of questions, trying to find out what individual hotels were doing. Manav made contact with Samina Sharp, owner of a Holiday Inn Express 2,000 miles away in San Jose, California.
One of the common themes in dealing with IHG is the stonewalled, one-sided communication. And I felt like for the first time I was talking to an owner who wanted to go beyond that.
Then, on March 17th, Manav's account on the owner's forum was disabled, though he says he didn't violate any code of conduct. He emailed a screenshot to a bunch of his colleagues.
And all of a sudden, you had a fury of hotel owners stand behind and say, this is not right. This is not a democratic way of running this organization.
They eventually reactivated his account and apologized. Samina and Mana formed a new ad hoc organization called the Hotel Owners Community to advocate for more relief. Samina started firing off sharply critical open letters and emails to corporate saying things like,
while your executive team is mulling over options on how best not to let your stock price further tank, we are here dealing with the crisis firsthand.
IHG has made some changes, including relaxing standards and offering discounts off marketing and reservation fees. Samina tells me that doesn't really help.
You're going to laugh when you hear how mind-boggling this is. It's really great marketing is what it is. Okay, well, what are they based on marketing fee and the reservation fee on? Gross rooms revenue. So you have to sell rooms in order to pay these fees. But as you know from talking to us, we don't have any revenue. So 0 times 3 is still 0. 0 times 25 is 0. Not a lot of huge breaks there, right?
Samina says what she and other hotel owners really need is more of a break on the fixed fees they're still paying to IHG. Fees that other hotel companies like Best Western have relaxed for their franchises.
I don't understand why I'm paying $14.65 times 57 rooms, which comes out to about, $835 per month. That doesn't go away. Whether I sell rooms or not, I still have to pay that.
For their part, IHG says they have offered some fee relief. In an emailed statement, a spokesperson said they've been working to support franchisees since the beginning of the crisis, Through the IHG Owners Association, by cutting corporate costs, including salaries, deferring planned upgrades and renovations, and hosting webinars for owners. But Samina says she's still not getting the support she needs. So on April 10th, she furloughed her workers and closed her hotel down.
I'm not going to stay operational and take all the risks just so IHG can make money. They're the last people on my list of things I care about right now.
So we're joined this afternoon by the true leaders of our nation's travel, hospitality, and tourism industry.
On March 17th, the same day Manav's account on the owners forum was shut down, President Trump met with executives from some of the biggest names in the hotel industry. IHG's CEO was there.
Thank you, Mr. President. Ellie Maloof with Intercontinental Hotels Group, Chief Executive of the Americas. We have nearly 6,000 hotels around the world, over 3,800 hotels.
Samina says she heard about the meeting, but didn't feel like it had anything to do with her.
There is such distance between me, people in my position, licensees, and the CEOs of these corporations. They sort of treat their franchisees as a part of the team when it suits them to bolster their numbers and look big and mighty. But then when it comes down to actually getting the spoils of war, then it's like, okay, well, it's for our corporate employees. You know, we're left entirely out of the conversation.
And so I think I'm very pleased that we can work together with you and the administration to find a solution to preserve that network of entrepreneurs across the country.
Yep, we will.
Thanks. You.
8 days later, the president signed the federal government's $2.2 trillion coronavirus rescue package into law. Manoff says he's glad the stimulus package includes several items like small business loans and tax breaks that could help franchisees. But he says the loans will just add to the debt that hotel owners can barely manage as it is.
There are a lot of hoteliers that have not been able to meet their debt services this month. That is a fact.
The Stimulus Act's major allocation, the $350 billion Paycheck Protection Program, was set up to give loans to small businesses to cover payroll and some operating costs. Some or all of these loans can be forgiven if a company keeps wages at or close to pre-virus levels and doesn't lay anyone off. But by the middle of April, the program had already run out of money. Manoff did apply, but he says the maximum loan amounts aren't even enough for most hotel owners to cover payroll, operational, and mortgage costs, plus the franchise fees that many are still paying.
It's just made everybody realize that we are on our own. And when this is over, we'll see who survives.
The largest hotel owners trade group, the Asian American Hotel Owners Association, says the federal relief package will not prevent mass layoffs. They also expect to see a large number of foreclosures and failed businesses as franchise owners default on loans in the coming months.
Conditions like this are why the hotel industry is set up the way that it is.
Pavan Dhingra is a sociologist at Amherst College, an author of a book about the hotel and motel industry.
It can benefit during good times, but during bad times, it's relatively insulated from as much damage as would otherwise be.
But the people who will be hit hardest are the employees, working in an industry where all the pressures to cut costs are aimed downward at the lowest rungs of the ladder.
These are not highly paid jobs, definitely not glamorous jobs. They are oftentimes part-time jobs. They may not have full benefits that we would hope people to get. So quickly, right, these are individuals who will either go from full-time to part-time or part-time to unemployed, because the most important thing to do for these owners is finding a way to cut costs when there's less income coming in. It's a simple matter of arithmetic.
Nearly 4 million workers in the hotel industry have already been furloughed or are expected to lose their jobs in the next few weeks. Back at Manoff's Holiday Inn in Columbus, front desk clerk Mo Islam still plans on showing up for work.
I believe within couple months, maybe we get back again, everything get together. I wish.
If this job wasn't around or you get laid off, like, what options do you have?
Actually, I have no option other than that. Then I have to find out a new job because what my expense not stop. If the company lay off, then I can survive maximum 2 months. After that, I have to find out the new job. Give me 1 second, please, okay?
Yeah, of course, of course.
Providing the assistance you need. Please hold. We'll be right with you.
Thanks to Jonathan Jones for that story. We made multiple requests to interview IHG executives, but they declined. Manav Singh is one of several hotel franchise owners who've posted petitions online asking corporate brands for more financial support. By mid-April, close to 15,000 signatures have been gathered. Small business owners of all kinds are suffering in the wake of COVID-19, from restaurants to art galleries to dog grooming parlors. We'll check in with one neighborhood outside of Seattle and see how their shops are faring. Up next on Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. We're going to do something now that people aren't doing much of these days. Taking a stroll down the street in
beautiful White Center, we offer public roller skating for families, as well as adult-only nights, 21 and over with a bar. We offer birthday party packs.
White Center. It's an urban neighborhood in King County, just south of Seattle. The roller rink sits on 16th Avenue, the main drag here since 1908. The rink's shiny disco ball has stopped spinning. Its doors are closed due to the coronavirus, like many of the more than 200 businesses here. Many of them started by immigrants from Vietnam, Cambodia, East Africa, and Latin America. As we head north up the street, on our right, we pass Fa Noodle Shop, Nirvana Cannabis Dispensary, Proletariat Pizza, and Smoketown, which is still open for now.
We had a mad rush for about roughly 10 days. I think people were kind of worried about where they were going to get their nicotine fix.
Owner Paul Kim moved here from Guam 25 years ago.
April first rolled around and we noticed the impact of people not working. Sales are down, noticed a lot of people bringing in change. Usually you'll see change at the end of the month, but we see it very early, which is very disturbing as a business owner. And then, that's only April.
Next door to Paul is Aaron's bicycle repair.
Hang on a second. Come in. Just duck under. Yeah, I got a customer.
Aaron Goss runs the place with his one employee. Business is good right now, thanks to sunny weather and a craving for outdoor exercise.
We only allow one customer in the store at a time, and they must wear a mask. We sanitize their bike before and after, and we sanitize their credit card.
Right across the street is Full Tilt Ice Cream.
We like to say Seattle's most punk rock ice cream place.
Hannah Ray Bracey works at the store and says the owner stayed open at first.
People tried really hard to support the business. We would have people come out just to support our business. That's the only reason they bought ice cream.
But it got too hard. The shop shut down, laying off the staff. Hannah's collecting unemployment and trying to market her skills as an artist online, but that community is also taking a hit.
My name is Jake Prendez, and I am the owner and co-director of the Nafantla Cultural Arts Gallery.
It's a cultural center and gift shop featuring White Center artists.
We just made our exhibition a virtual gallery. And so you can contact the artist, you can purchase the art directly from the artist.
Local artists are also painting murals on newly boarded up buildings with messages like, "In this together" and "Stay safe." Reveal's Emily Harris has been talking to business owners in White Center. It's a window into how the coronavirus is affecting the 30 million small businesses around the country, and the changes that communities like this will face as they struggle to survive.
White Center got associated with the coronavirus early on. There were no reported cases there, but it was the first spot county officials chose to put a quarantine facility, temporary trailers with isolation rooms for up to 40 people.
I found out about it maybe 10 minutes before the press release. And was just extremely irritated.
Sidi Savusa leads the White Center Community Development Association, a nonprofit that supports families and small businesses. She didn't question the need for quarantine centers around Seattle. She questioned the powers that be imposing it on White Center, a low-income, long-time immigrant neighborhood with little political clout.
This wasn't about not wanting to help people who have to deal with corona. It's just, look where you're putting it. You're continuing to perpetuate, you know, this whole institutionalized racism and not giving white center community a voice in something like this that's really important.
Anna Castro heard about plans for the quarantine center from her sister. The two have owned a bakery and restaurant in White Center for almost 25 years.
And I say, no. And then I say, why? And then I thought, well, if we have that here, we're not going to have any customer coming to our bakery.
The center still hasn't opened, but the coronavirus has nearly shut down Anna's business anyway. She's only doing takeout and had to lay off half the employees. She and her sister now work 7 days a week. They clean, they sell, they enforce social distancing. Other family members have stepped in to help for free. Anna can't stop the questions rolling in her mind.
I thought, how are we going to keep up with our business? How are we going to survive? And we were thinking about our retirement, planning our retirement. And now this, it seems like, your life is ending.
Anna got her application into the new $350 billion Paycheck Protection Program before it ran out of money this past week. Small businesses across the country applied, including us here at Reveal. If Anna gets approved, that could help her pay the handful of employees she still has and maybe hire some back.
We are a family business, and we care about our employees, and a lot of them depend from us. I have a family that she's the only one working right now here because her husband and her son, they lay him off, and this is the only job that she has at this moment.
Anna also has utility bills and rent. She says the power company and her landlord said she could pay later, but eventually she'd have to pay in full.
This is a small business, not Boeing or Microsoft or Amazon. I can't survive any longer if we don't, get any help.
Anna applied for a local grant from the White Center Community Development Association. They've set aside $100,000 for businesses hurt by coronavirus closures. The amount is so tiny compared to the need, as small as the virus itself, you might say. Helen Shorewong is in charge of figuring out the guidelines for those grants. She is sitting down with local business owners to find out what they need.
So we go through the questions of, with the merchant, you know, where would you put the grant dollars if we gave them to you? And right there, they're going right to rent. Just goes back to the landlord. It goes back to the property owner.
Paying rent is vital to keep many local merchants from going under right now. But Helen would rather see the rescue money stay with local businesses instead of going to their landlords.
I think the hardest part of this is, I think, the inequity prior to COVID. It's going to still be there after COVID, but with, I think, a greater intensity.
A 15-minute walk from Anna's bakery, Deborah Schwarzkopf runs Rat City Studios, a ceramics workshop. Right now, a lot of her cash is tied up in clay. She shows me on video conference a wall of cardboard boxes.
Each box is 50 pounds of clay, and they are stacked 5 high in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 rows. And this is both for myself and for the classes that I would have held.
She walks outside to show me her studio expansion plans that are now on hold.
The day that I filed for permits to get my kiln extension going, the King County permit office closed, so that's on hold. Not to mention I can't pay for it now.
Deb earns a living selling pottery, teaching classes here and around the country, and training young potters. When the coronavirus canceled a big national ceramics conference, she lost thousands of dollars in sales and workshops. She is earning some money by teaching ceramics classes online for the first time.
I have gotten, I think, a great response. I've also spent a ridiculous amount of money on cords and dongles in order to get everything to hook up. It's like, I've ordered so many wrong cords, it's stupid.
Like Anna, Deb is applying for any help she can.
I have applied for a Facebook grant, a Verizon grant. I've applied for an SBA loan, a BECU loan, which is my bank.
BECU is a credit union with a neighborhood office in White Center. Shortly after Deb applied, it and many other banks got overwhelmed and stopped taking applications for the Paycheck Protection Program. Then, 10 days after opening, the federal government shut the program's doors, saying available funding had run out. Helen Shore Wong says that many White Center business owners didn't even get a chance to apply. They told her that from the start, they kept running into walls.
So Helen, I'm part of U.S. Bank. You know, I've asked them about the PPP, but they're not ready. Or, oh, Helen, I talked with my bank and they're not even processing the PPP. And then you get the bank that says, you know, we're already over committed. And so what happens is many of our community businesses will come in a little bit late in the game. So it's a very difficult situation. It's kind of causes paralysis, actually. I mean, it's so overwhelming.
Like Anna at the bakery, Deb has no idea what her ceramics business will look like on the other side of this pandemic.
Just feeling motivated to keep going is kind of hard because it feels complex and uncertain. Yeah.
Many of the business owners I spoke with in White Center are doing the same as Deb and Anna are, trying to stay afloat in new ways, applying for whatever help they can. But Young Cho is an exception. Back in February, he posted a video on Facebook announcing that he was about to turn his popular Tex-Mex Asian fusion food cart into a brick-and-mortar restaurant in White Center. But COVID-19 changed his plans.
I just knew I wouldn't be able to open essentially any time in the near future.
As far as Young can tell, he doesn't qualify for any financial help, local or federal.
Because I don't have payroll established, I technically haven't opened my doors. I'm not eligible for any of these programs. I mean, I've talked to CPAs and a couple of lawyer buddies of mine and a couple of finance guys, and they're just pretty much all kind of had the same consensus. I'm in that gray area.
He had staff lined up, but hadn't hired them. He's paying rent on his new restaurant, but can't open. His food truck is all but closed. He's offering his Facebook followers a few dishes delivered. Truck business was supposed to bring in cash for the restaurant renovations. Young figures he's already about $20,000 behind where he needs to be to open. He's borrowing from friends and wondering how long he can hold on.
It's like having a child in the middle of a zombie apocalypse is just kind of where I'm feeling like I'm at. It's like my child, but I can't release it into this world because impending doom is likely, you know?
For small businesses, that impending doom would be closing doors forever. If that happens widely across the country, it could keep unemployment high for a long time. In White Center, community leaders have another worry, too. If COVID-19 closures here turn into bankruptcies, outside investors could swoop in, buy up immigrant-owned businesses, bring about more gentrification, and perhaps fundamentally change the character of this community.
Thanks to Reveal's Emily Harris for bringing us the vibe of White Center, even virtually. Finally today, we have the story of another chef who's doing whatever he can to keep his business alive, to support his employees and his community. Here's reporter Tina Antolini with that story.
In 2005, just days after Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath devastated New Orleans, Chef Alon Shaya found himself in the parking lot of a looted Walmart. He set up a propane burner and a giant pot.
And made the worst pot of red beans and rice I'd ever made in my life. No onions, no peppers, no sausage.
But the simplicity didn't seem to matter to the people who were eating. Everyone in the parking lot gathered around his table.
I was feeding people who either had just been rescued from the roofs of their homes or people who were rescuing those people from the roofs of their homes.
Alon, who's originally from Israel, says the experience changed him.
It drove me to fall in love with New Orleans. I mean, it gave me a sense that I can contribute something, a feeling like I was needed. And I'd never felt that way from a city before.
It's still his impulse to feed people now, as his city has been thrust into the crisis of COVID-19. But the necessity of social distancing has been disorienting.
It's just been so much more confusing, and it's been so much scarier because I feel like there's just this hurricane blowing through the air into people's lungs, and you can't see it on a radar. You don't know where it's coming from. You don't know if the eye of the storm is here yet or not.
I've known Alon for years, eaten in his restaurants, collaborated with him on a cookbook, and never in all that time have I seen him so distressed. He and his wife Emily run their two Israeli restaurants, one in New Orleans and one in Denver, together. Emily says they could feel the storm gathering back on Friday night, March 13th. They were at their New Orleans restaurant, Saba.
We actually were busier than we've ever been because I think people maybe also saw it coming down the line and were going out to support the restaurants while they could.
Alon says dining rooms all over New Orleans were packed.
I drove down Magazine Street and saw the bars overflowing with people and the coffee shops overflowing with people. And it felt like this very eerie experience of like watching the news. I'm hearing about this storm that's about to hit us.
By midday on that Sunday, the mayor announced that hundreds of restaurants in the city would have to close their dining rooms by 9 p.m. that night.
Restaurants shall be limited in terms of their operations to takeout, delivery, or pickup. This includes...
And then Monday, the day after, Emily and I had the worst day of our entire lives.
Alon called every single member of their staff at both their restaurants, Saba in New Orleans and Safta, their outpost in Denver, another city going into lockdown. He had to tell dozens and dozens of his employees that they were going to be furloughed.
And I spent all day on the phone talking to every team member or texting with them. And I felt like we just kind of like failed.
Next, it became a dance of trying to keep as many people still working as possible while exposing them to the least amount of risk. Both restaurants pivoted to takeout and delivery, neither of which they'd done before.
We got gloves, we got masks, we got sanitizer. You know, we set up a pickup area for the guests so that we wouldn't have to come into contact with them. We shifted to just putting the bag of food on the hood of someone's car.
Each morning at the restaurants, they took everyone's temperature. But Emily says they still worried about whether it was safe.
It was just an uneasiness about being out there in front of customers and thinking, like, if we were only breaking even or losing money, and if that's what's happening, it's not worth it to be open.
They weren't the only ones feeling that way. There's a sense of desperation from all corners of the restaurant industry, which operates on such thin margins that many are scraping by in normal times. Alon and Emily pivoted again. In New Orleans, they stopped doing takeout and started selling hummus and pita to a local grocery store chain. They turned Safta, their restaurant in Denver, into a crisis relief center, feeding hundreds of now unemployed restaurant workers each day.
We've been giving out toilet paper. We have an Amazon registry for diapers, baby food, personal hygiene products, and things like that that are being sent to the restaurant for us to give out.
The Relief Center is part of a national initiative, the Restaurant Workers Relief Program, organized by a chef in Kentucky, Edward Lee. All over the country, restaurants are figuring out new ways of caring for people, whether it's cooking for homeless folks, converting into grocery stores, or banding together to feed and fundraise for the millions of hospitality workers who have already lost their jobs. Meanwhile, in New Orleans, the number of COVID-19 cases was skyrocketing. Alon and Emily decided to change course yet again. Even doing hummus and pita delivery to the grocery stores started feeling too dangerous.
So we shut that operation down, and now we've pivoted to just myself in my home kitchen cooking meals for doctors and nurses. So today, I am cooking at my house for the NOLA Doc Project, which is helping other medical residents get food every day at work. And I figured, why not make some pita bread at the house? So I have my broiler on.
In many ways, Alon and Emily are luckier than some. They have a strong network of connections to lean on.
Rolling out some dough. And
their restaurants likely qualify for help from the government stimulus package passed last month.
And we're going to serve that up with some hummus today as well, with roasted asparagus and tahini and Aleppo pepper.
And while they can't do what comes naturally, gather people physically together, they're keeping busy exploring new ways to connect and be of help to their communities through food.
Okay,
we're on.
Welcome. We're going to be cooking some buttermilk biscuits.
Alon's been fundraising for other relief efforts with online cooking demos, showing people how to make things like biscuits and kale jambalaya. It's still a bit of a work in progress. He tried to make his dog, Chechi, the taste tester.
What do you think, Chechi?
She didn't approve.
She spit it out. She spit it out.
Okay.
Well, there you go, world.
In such uncertain times, the laughter feels as soothing as the food.
Thanks to Tina Antolini for that story. Catherine Moskowski, Najib Amini, and Emily Harris produced today's show. It was edited by Brett Myers, Jen Chien, and Kevin Sullivan, with help from Esther Kaplan. Taki Telenidis is our senior supervising editor. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Mwende Inahosa. Our sound design team is the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help this week from Amy Mustafa. Our CEO is Krista Scharfenberg. Matt Thompson is our editor-in-chief. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveals provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson. And remember, the only way through this is together.
From PRX.